Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. Lila won't be joining us tonight. She's packing and stuff, and she has to get ready for, we're leaving at 5 in the morning, I guess, tomorrow morning. But tonight we have George Dixon joining us, and we're going to be discussing Ross Hamilton's book and some of the and other things with A Tradition of Giants is the name of the book written by Ross Hamilton. However, a gentleman named Brendan, I'm not sure exactly, and if you're out there, Brendan, I know you're going to be joining us very shortly, but who is also an expert in this field, is going to be talking for Ross Hamilton. So I want to thank everybody for joining us. I hope last night I did an entire program on this book and talking about it, so for those of you who might want more background on what the Tradition of Giants is, go to last night's show, and you can get a pretty good introduction of that right after this. But right now, George is on. I don't know if George is on or Brendan is on. Hang on one second. Good evening, Brendan.
Good evening, Leo. Brendan here.
Hi, Brendan. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for the invite.
Well, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. I wasn't aware about Ross being incapacitated, but I want to tell you you're more than welcome, and it was a fascinating book. From what I haven't been able to read the entire thing, but George had made me somewhat aware of Giants for some time now, and I have the book in front of me. And I did an entire program on it last night, so so people can get an idea of what we're talking about. But I appreciate you being on, and I think I got George here.
Hang on a second.
Hey, George, how are you?
Well, I'm fine. How about you?
Very good. I have Brendan here joining us, and Brendan, I'm sorry, I don't have your last name.
Okay, sort of like the general, the Ellis Islandism is Brigadier. We'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Brendan Brigadier. Okay. Well, I'm glad we have you on. And George, what it was great inviting Brendan. And
let me give a bit of a background. I met Brendan several years ago. It was at a Montauk night meeting there in Long Island at Peter Moon's place. At one time, every month, I used to have a Montauk night. And they would discuss the Montauk series. And, of course, Preston used to conduct the meetings. And we had a hell of a good time. And Brendan, I met one time at one of the meetings. And since then, you know, we've talked about many many issues we have in common and talking about interests, I should say. Brendan is very knowledgeable, I think, with Giants. And at that time, I was doing some research into Giant structured people, and I was comparing some of the knowledge that I had, you know, going back to the Egyptian heritage, and which dealt with off-planet cultures. But I'll say no more at this point and leave it up to Leo. Go ahead and ask Brendan any questions dealing with Giants, and he can answer it.
I'll be happy to. Now, Leo, I just want to remind George that perhaps it slipped his memory, his interest in the Maya. At Palenque, Lord Pakal, widely reputed to be 8 foot tall, ultimately disappears into history, but we do know of the recollection of him, as well as in the Osage, a gentleman, George Catlin, an artist who went out with the Dodge expedition in the 1830s, actually came upon a 7-foot-tall-plus Indian of the Osage who was over 300 pounds. So we know his name also as a Black Dog. So there are historic personages who we can point to, and they even know their first names as giants. Now, these are not mutation people suffering gigantism as an illness. These are family lineages, just like I think was Goliath and Og in the Bible. Those were not just individual giants, but actually family lineages of giant people.
I was curious as to probably the first, well, of course, yeah, the first concepts that I heard as a child about giants was, you know, Jack and the Beanstalk and fairy tales and so on. But later, I giants have always played a significant role in mythology and human history, and legends, and you know, they've always been mythological and so on. But you had literature and history is loaded with references to extremely large people. And I was thinking of the artist Goya, the Spanish artist who dedicated many palettes to giants, you know, the giant series, and his giants were you know, tall men, I mean, like 50, 60 feet tall, you know what I mean, big giants, but there are so many giants, for instance, Goliath, or in the Bible, or and in pagan culture, you know, but you know, you had trolls, or you had giant monsters that are continually, and it wouldn't surprise me that, I mean, when you think about the dinosaur and the size of the of the animals back in that period, in the dinosaur period, that men, if there were men or giants, would have been large, probably large beings as well.
Oh, agreed. In fact, Leo, although I fail to recall the actual reference, there appears to be a full-scale mammoth, let's call it a pictograph, pecked into some wall that has alongside the other megafauna represented huge Pleistocene man, which was shown to be pretty much head to the top shoulder of the great woolly mammoth. And if that's the 12 to 14 foot range, I think we could probably suggest that the megafauna of 12, 15, 20,000 years ago here in North America may well have included humans in that size range.
Right. It wouldn't surprise me. And then legends, which, you know, so many legends, I mean, men like Paul Bunyan or things like that, and other men who've been very large. In your book, they talk about the Ojida, I believe, the old, I forgot which tribe it was, the name of the tribe.
Odina?
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, the Adena as a lost, perhaps, race of
giant,
large people who were had among them against an ancient family lineage of giants who were, let's say, along the lines of Goliath. The idea being that these were, in the Adena, a group of people who've been typed in more recent years, previously maybe associated with what would be known as the Lenape, the Lenni Lenape, or also known as the Delaware, as being the Ohio Valley people who may have originated a lot of the tall people later reported by the early European entrants, such as in the Cherokee people, again, the Osage, even the Carib people, and, of course, John Smith's visit to Chesapeake Bay and his meeting up with the Susquehanna. We're all having people, yes, tall, six-footers, but then a goodly number in excess of 7 feet.
You don't hear about this stuff, even with the folklore, you know, of the American Indians, and yet so much of it has been watered down, where you don't know what to believe anymore when it's mentioned about some of the giant structured people. But years ago, we talked about some of the giant races of beings that came from off-planet that were mixed in a lot of our civilizations of antiquity. and we mentioned, the Syrian beings as one being, and they were connected with Queen Nefertiti and Akhenaten, where Queen Nefertiti was, I believe, 14'6", and her husband was 16 feet tall.
That's right. And the Anunnaki, who were the, were the original big people, seemed to, that became the their part of their lineage, it would appear.
Well, even if we wanted to step back, Leo, for a second, sorry to jump in on the idea with the big feet and the appendages here. I may be a little bit gigantic in the ego, but let me refer back also to, is it the correct pronunciation, the Nephilim of the Bible, who were the, again, as giants walked the earth in Genesis, we understand that the gods may have laid with the women of the earth and as a result produced a certain class of giants that were referred to, I think, by the name Nephilim.
The hybrids.
But it was a it didn't work out so well for them, and there's something for the women. I believe giving birth to these giants, they had to come up with with a better plan. It seemed, but they. The Book of Enoch has that in it, and it talks about these fallen angels. But a fallen angel. I think it sounds more like it was possibly a group of aliens.
Well, certainly I agree. I mean, as we are all made of stardust, I wonder about the specious use of the word alien to begin with, but. As far as Ross Hamilton's book, A Tradition of Giants, I'm not quite sure if it took Ross 10 or 15 years to do the research. His book then was published in 2005, and if I could just give a website for Ross Hamilton, who's not here tonight.
Please.
Yeah, he's able to be contacted at ophi@greatserpentmound.org, and that's that great serpent mound that occurs in the Ohio Valley area that's also possibly attributed, as George Dixon was referring to, the Adena, as possibly the people who formed this great effigy to the Kundalini spirit force, not at the time probably recognized by that name by these people, as perhaps Ross and his mentor of sorts, the great late author Vine Deloria Jr., who in Red Earth, White Lies actually gives us a reference to some earlier work where the gas carbon dioxide may have actually affected and spurred on the growth over many generations, both the fauna and flora, to produce giants. So we're now in a period of carbon dioxide increase. Who can tell what may yet arise?
What is the name of that site again, that website for Ross?
Yeah, Ross's website, he has an earlier book, The Mystery of the Serpent Mound, is Ophi, O-P-H-I, the @, and it's great.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
Oh, wait. Oh, what?
O-P-H-I.
H-I.
@.
S-I.
Yeah, the @. So it's Ophi at greatserpentmound.org. And I'll, again, greatserpentmound.org.
That's it. Okay. Alfie.
O-P-H-I at greatserpentmound.org.
We'll, again, I'll give that later on in the show.
Yeah.
If
I could just mention that it seems to me that Vine Deloria refers in his book, Red Earth, White Lies, Leo, just for a second, to a gentleman, Donald Patton, who wrote an article back in the 70s, A Comprehensive Theory on Aging, Gigantism, and Longevity. And in the review by Vine Deloria, late great author, he speaks here that the carbon dioxide concentrations were sufficiently great that, of course, the goosing of the plant life was obvious, but then there seems to be a effect in the brain, and then say the other tissue response following form, and stretching these average-sized diminutive humans into the giants we're speaking of.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think the lineage of the Americans, giants, do you think that is a different lineage than, let's say, the Adam and Eve lineage from Mesopotamia?
Ross Hamilton is of the mind in some recent work here on the mound culture and the serpent mound itself that we may have it backwards, and that the Garden of Eden, to some who think along these lines, is actually the Ohio Valley near the Serpent Mound, near Brush Creek, just north of, is it Peebles, Ohio, not far from Cincinnati, and that they went out from that garden, which is, of course, contrary to, the Crescent and Mesopotamia, as the other thought. So whether, George, we're talking about panspermia, and there were many centers of dispersal, that the North American continent seems to have a history by some measure backwards of 50,000 or more years. I'd cite, for instance, American Genesis by another author, Dr. Jeffrey Goodman's book, which was something that the Indian author, Brian Deloria, was agreed with.
Yeah. Well, we've talked many a nights, I think, in connecting the Anunnaki with the 12th planet. And, it's hard to believe that, the lineage that Zechariah Sitchin talks about in the Earth Chronicles in his series only goes back about 210 to 212,000 years ago. And yet, some of the lineages of the American Indians or people from the Americas, I look at them as another race that originated, let's say, from the island of Lemuria and the island of Mu, which goes back thousands of years before Atlantis, or in, the accumulating the building of the Atlantis nation or culture was separate from the Lemurians. And, I'm just curious where the lineage lies, for the American people compared to, the Middle East and Mesopotamia and so forth in China.
I accept your characterization, George. I'm not as well read on that topic. And Leo chiming in here, too, you may appreciate that I've been in touch then also with this gentleman, Vine Deloria Jr., and I just happen to have a letter here with a quick quote here out of a 2003 letter from him to me, and he says he's working on such matters and is in touch with Zechariah Sitchin, who has his own scenario regarding the creation of the universe, as well as the scenario dealing with the giants that Donald Patton was discussing. So I feel that there's enough overlap here that whoever wants to claim the first giant, I wasn't there, so I'm no arbiter here.
Well, do you think that the code or the quietness or the secrecy of this, you think it's been released to the public, and you think this is part of the trend that we're seeing from the halls of academia, that they can't hold on to this knowledge anymore or control it? With the technology and the knowledge that we have, that it's something that is to the open market.
I'd say they've kicked in the door, both the diminutive and the giant. You and I spoke recently about the earthquake in Banda Aceh in 2004, was it, or 5, where we felt that the hobbit, the Homo florentiensis, the Flores, three-footers that we're finding out there might be the other end of the spectrum, and that the legend is that the portals would be associated with an opening of the door with a great earthquake. And in that same time frame, the three-foot hobbit people were identified and now almost agreed by increasing numbers to be recognized as a separate species. So too, then, why couldn't we go through the looking glass and imagine that the other end of the telescope makes for not the 6 foot, but doubling up to the 12 foot size people that some of these giants, I think, encompass. So I feel that from a lot of different angles, George and Leo, we're talking about actual beings, and be it oral tradition or written, or even by intaglio or by writing on walls of caves, we are talking about real entities surviving here over a period of time and their remains having been found.
Mm-hmm. Well, Leo, what do you think about all of this?
Just listening. I mean, you guys know a lot more than I do. I'm just more, I'm just curious, you know, and hope you have, you know, interested in what you guys have to say. I don't know. As I went through this, I mean, these people have been validated by it. I mean, Lewis and Clark found these
yes.
people and notified Jefferson and Thomas Jefferson.
All throughout the early history of America, Leo is so fortunate to have just those highly regarded and esteemed witnesses to it. In fact, I think what Jefferson was speaking of was an early 1805 visit by Osage chieftains to Washington for the purpose of treating and ultimately treaty negotiations.
I mean, that's true, but again, he would. I mean, he was the one who hired Lewis and Clark, so they would have through the Louisiana Purchase, they would have notified him of.
Yes, in fact, there was the reputation of the mammoth still existing in the western states, and one of the giants that Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark out to find was the woolly mammoth. Now, at this point, we feel that the mammoth was already become a pygmy and really limited in maybe places such as the off islands of the Aleutians and maybe Siberia, and probably died out about 4,000 years ago. So they were chasing after the long hairy ones on 4 feet, but what in fact they came across were still living ones in the 7 to plus 7 foot tall living Native Americans or Native peoples that Lewis and Clark came by. And you're right about that, Leo, that this is where our country begins to memorialize it. And yet, if you go back into earlier history, we'll find reports in the old town records and the French, Spanish, and English travel reports in the 15th and 16th century also making account of a number of tribes with very huge people.
Yeah.
Brendan, do you run across much information about the inner earth and giants from the inner earth or legends of tribes using the inner earth as a base?
Perhaps through our friend David Hatcher Childress. He's also got a book out on the mammoth, or rather the Yeti, Bigfoot types. And we have heard those stories of the flash of light and conceivably a portal opening and closing quickly with the emergence or disappearance of the, say, more Bigfoot Yeti types. But the giants I think we're speaking of here are those that we find mostly reported in the old Smithsonian and National Museum reports that I had the pleasure of going through for about 2 or 3 years for Ross, since they hadn't yet been put onto the computer for easy research. And in those, we found that a number of the field workers before the Smithsonian and then during its early 1800s to turn of the century 1900 time frame, hundreds of reports of uncovered bony remains measured in situ upwards of 8 and sometimes 9 feet. So I feel that the evidence is there, George.
Yeah.
If I could point you, gentlemen, also to a Nexus magazine article, it turns out that Ross Hamilton, in his writing on this, happened to put out, and that's the Nexus New Times magazine. I don't know if it's still being published, but there's a July-August 2003 issue. It's volume 10, number 4, and there on page 47, the title is Holocaust of Giants, the Great Smithsonian Cover-Up, and it is an article by Ross Hamilton. And Ross is writing on the Smithsonian issue, George and Leo, because of a challenge that David Hatcher Childress had put out there for those of us who research giants to uncover the, I'd say, underhanded way that the Smithsonian dealt with this evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. I remember the article. I've been a subscriber to Nexus for years and years, and I remember reading that. And if nothing else, it's part of information that was new, I think, to the field, where you didn't hear about stuff like this, and
well,
especially from academia.
According to what I read in this book, they've discarded it. The Smithsonian discarded a lot of this evidence.
It certainly is the case. Sort of the movie comes to mind, of course. With the, I'm trying to think of the name again here, George, you'll help me, with the Ark of the Covenant. It was the Indiana Jones movie. At the end of the movie, Leo, you remember they box up the Ark of the Covenant and put it onto a dolly and roll it out in the...
to a warehouse.
Warehouse this stuff. So I think, too, there, Leo, is a lot of what's happened. It's been warehoused, and like you said, Leo, possibly dumped into the Chesapeake Bay, not far from the grounds of the Smithsonian. So some nighttime activities, not just people with cement overshoes, were, I think, lodged there.
That's exactly my that is exactly my argument with archaeology, with so many of the sciences, is that. I mean, even to the point of global warming and whatnot, is that they scientists falsify so much evidence or discard so much evidence that doesn't fit their theory, right? That you know you can barely count on any of this stuff being real. It's like I was reading a story about Peking Man. Mm-hmm. That it was found by it was actually discovered by a Jesuit, and what it did is it disproved, of course, the creation theory, you know, and so on. And his find was so great that he was kicked out of the Jesuits because he wanted to reveal it, and that's how the Peking Man story developed. That he found evidence. He was an archaeologist as well. And as a Jesuit priest, and he found this the Peking skeleton that was way far earlier than you know the church stated that the world was only so many thousands of years old, but it went against all church teachings.
Yeah,
so,
that's the biblical timeline that I think even the early Smithsonian adhered to. During the time of, can you believe it, the gentleman who went down the Colorado for the first time with the one arm, Major John Wesley Powell, up to be at the Smithsonian at about this time frame too, and he and others are very much clinging to the cloth of the Bible time frame for early humankind being in the New World here. But
Get
some context on that. My background in geophysical engineering and being also an attorney, environmental attorney, I've been trying to, with Ross, scrupulously go over the Smithsonian reports. And if you read his book all the way through, you'll see some, 30 or 40 pages worth of notes at the back. It's almost written, I think you might agree, Leo, as if it's a legal brief to support with, yes, snippets and anecdotes but a well-reasoned, argued, and I think weighty with evidence from a very reputable institution. But whether or not they have obscured and skewed the evidence by hiding it in the back room, later directors of the Smithsonian actually beginning to forget the labeling numbers of the large bones, and in modern days, if one were to undertake to make a outside of the institution inquiry, it all seems to fall on deaf ears, whether it's a lack of staffing or that the embarrassment of having to tell of past mistakes of made by individuals. It seems to me we need a good Smithsonian secretary director and heads of these departments to unbundle the truths that I think lie there.
I don't personally think that it's them, actually. It must be an established policy, because I'm sure that they do this on a continual basis with not evidence of a lot of other stuff. Keep us all in line. There's another gentleman who looks like he might want to join us here. Hang on one second. Yeah, 402, welcome to the show. Would you like to ask a question?
Hello? I would. I'm not a gentleman, though, I have to admit.
What's your name?
Karen.
What is your name? Hello?
Karen.
Karen.
Karen?
Yes,
welcome, Karen.
Where are you calling from?
Actually, I live in Colorado, but I have some very interesting property in Utah. I was supposed to go there tonight, and I wasn't able to make it, so I'm glad that I synchronistically ended up listening to this show, because giants are one of my favorite topics. And I had somebody that was with me in Utah about 2 months ago that has studied the giants and a few other topics, and actually he's part of the church in Utah, and I'm not, but he is, and he said the church has done a lot to whisk away the evidence of giants. He's been on two digs himself.
Are you talking about
found giants?
You're talking about the Mormon
church.
Mormon church. Yeah.
Now this is coming from a Mormon, not you know, and
yeah.
But because it goes against their particular archaeology, that they kind of do what is done nationally in Utah, and he's been on a couple of digs where they ended up, you know, somehow getting, he says they'll go to any means to get that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to mention that George had brought this up before on our shows, but about the tremendous historical archives and genealogies that the Mormon Church has collected over these many, many years. And they're continually contributing, it looks like, to that through archaeological finds and so on. Is that what's happening there? Do they have their own?
Well, I guess I'm asking, too, with that, does that include giants? Are they willing to come forward with information
about
giants?
Yeah, they must have evidence there, too, that either they're discarding or that they're, you know,
that's my understanding from two different Mormons that have, you know, studied some of the digs in Utah and been parts of them, actually, been a part of it. Now, and interestingly, I also went up, I found out that a relative of mine had left several hundred pages of materials in the Utah State Archives, and I went up there. I didn't know there was that much. I went online and saw that there was something. And so I went up there, and he had 800 pages of material on, like, the Spanish Trail and various other things that went on in the area. And there they were for everyone to see. So that was very interesting that those were there. But nobody probably puts any significance into, you know, what he left behind.
Well, you have
a question for you. I do have a question, actually. But
go ahead, please.
The question for you is, what is the latest find with giants, and what have they done with that? And what are people doing when they find this forbidden archaeology type of antiquities? Are are there ways and people that are available to protect those items and yet make them available to the public?
Well, I don't have much knowledge in from an academic point of view, but I think it's just identifying. That's the biggest problem, identifying what group that you're dealing with.
Probably also not bringing them forward to the Smithsonian, I'm sorry to say, because of its bad behavior shown by the likes of the on-staff Ailsherd-Litschke, which really started the saying, no, there are no big-bone people here, around about 1910. That's really, for the listener, the comment being that I would say, if it were to be found in the Mormon properties, that's one thing. But if there were Native peoples who could possibly claim some ownership or some heritage in the area, it might be to bring it through the Native people and see if their handling of that information might not be done with more respect and ultimate dissemination.
I think
even antiquities that might go back as far as Sumerian or Egyptian, or, you know, the kind of things that shouldn't be here in the United States that are found here anyway.
Well, we do have our sites, our sacred sites here in North America, and I have to say that real estate, that whole area there, is very important real estate. I think because of the energy patterns and geomagnetic patterns. And years
now,
ago,
which area are you talking about?
No, I'm talking about the Four Corners area. Let me just focus in on that area
there.
And that takes in Utah, Colorado, Arizona, and New Mexico. And there are Four Corners areas. There's been a lot of research, I think, from the peoples of that area, including the Anastasi, which, you know, take in part of the real estate of the Four Corners area. And, you know, the biggest question is what happened to the Anastasi, which you just got up and just disappeared. Of course, geologically, you know, the terrain has changed over the years and so forth. They weren't able to actually produce or produce food for them to grow or to live, and they moved on. But there's others who believe that they went into the inner earth. But the point of bringing this up, I think, is in that Four Corners area, there is a lot of there's a lot of information that's come to the surface in the last 20 years. And part of that, yes, the Mormons, the Latter-day Saints, have a keen interest in, I think, is because of the heritage that they followed, you know, with the energy fields and so forth. And I was brought into a situation where in lower Utah, there was a mountain, or a small mountain, but inside this mountain was an Indian village that goes back, you know, hundreds of years. And to make a long story short, this whole mountain had something like at least 12 to 15 stories. And they lived in the mountains, and what happened is that somebody blew up the entrances to the passageways into this mountain and closed off certain areas. But understand that inside you had the luxuries of a small village, and where they had running water, and they also had sewage. And on some of the areas that they blew up the entrances, it closed off or moved the flow of waste, which actually buried two or three different layers, you know, of this village. But the reason why it was brought up is because the Spaniards, the Jesuits, I should say, before they ended the invasion of the Americas, they had certain caches or depots that they would gather their gold in and at Smeltdown before they were shipped off to, you know, back to Europe. And every year, the Queen of Spain, I think, had 10 ships that would travel with the loot and so forth and take it over to Spain.
The cities
and,
of Cibola.
Excuse me?
The cities of Cibola.
Cibola? Yeah. Well, the problem is that they were identified in some of the shipwrecks that they found in the Caribbean. and they knew that this area or this village was a depot where they used to smelt down gold that was sent to them from all parts of the New World, smelted down, marked, and then they were shipped off to Europe. So, first of all, it's a matter of identifying some of the maps that were located with that. And I should say the maps were on metal scrolls, copper scrolls. And that's how they left the information on that. And I was brought in because what they found in some of the burial sites of this mountain was giant people. When I say giant people, anywhere from 12 to 15 feet tall. And it was identifying the type of people, who they were. And I tried to, I think, compare some of the language that they use, the pictographs and hieroglyphics, and as identifying with, I think, local or known cultures. Now, I'm talking about some of the ancient civilizations of antiquity, you know, before the before the Egyptians, and it was something that I it was a race that I couldn't identify, but they were interested, I think, in the people and the place itself, because apparently part of that area is being reactivated now with a changing of the subtle electromagnetic energies of our solar system, but also the Earth itself. And I'm rambling on here, but I think that whole area is very important, because it has an excess amount of electromagnetic energy. And there was a lot of research that was done during World War II because of the work that was done with electromagnetics. And, of course, Hitler was doing a lot of research without even creating vehicles that traveled by actually manipulating or engineering the electromagnetic energies around physical matter. I would say that everybody right now is interested in anything that's coming out of the area, because if nothing else, it taps into some of the old technology that we had. Now, when I say old technology, I'm talking about technology that they had with the computers. The Bible code is just one example.
Right. I have a question for you, because recently... I'm kind of on my own little Indiana Jones adventure here, and going to go into details, but I imagine there's going to be a time when everyone hears about it. But recently I found what I would intuitively believed and thought of immediately when I saw it, about an 8-foot stone guardian, Native American stone guardian of an area. And this area's been very protected spiritually, you know. It should have had massive amounts of people coming through because of a certain draw to the area, but there were no people through this area because of the kind of dirt that takes 50 years to form, being there and undisturbed. You could tell that it had not been stepped through. So what could you tell me about stone guardians and what they might represent? Well, I'm not sure if this was honed out by, people, or if it was some sort of natural / not natural.
Is it human, a form, a statuary? When you say a guardian, am I quite clear?
That's how it struck me intuitively, okay? And
Ross Hamilton's book, actually, Leo, you may have come across this in reading it. There's in the, I think, Cusick's report of early Iroquoian history going back into maybe 3,000 years, let's say, there were the known as stone giants. Now, these were...
I read that. Sure what that was, but yeah, stone giants.
Some of the stone giants, Leo, might have been along the lines of these huge people. And why were they called stone giants? There's been some speculation that they actually rolled themselves first in pitch from a tree and then onto the sand and pebble beaches of a river to be able to get an armor stuck and clung to them, against which, of course, any of the arrows from an enemy would bounce off of. So I find the use of the word here, stone effigy, as a guardian, to perhaps echo some of that as part and parcel of the giant lore.
I think these stone giants were up around the Great Lakes, St. Lawrence, I believe, where they were most populated, and they were also they were noted for being fierce warriors and fierce people and eating raw flesh, not cooking their meat. And they're also noted for cannibalism.
Agreed. Possibly also those.
I'm really hoping not to run into that kind.
They may be some of the ones, Leo, too, with the reported double row of teeth, which we found in some of the giant skulls reported by the Smithsonian as well.
Yeah, they had that as well, and didn't tell anybody. So it's amazing. And you got to wonder, you really have to wonder what marvels are out there, that are just not being reported.
Well, this, I'm doing personal exploration. It's mostly based on intuitive understanding of what's there. But then I had somebody remote view a particular piece and said, "You've got caves here." I go, "I do." And sure enough, this person's over in the UK.
I
found the caves. And we're just starting to explore them. Of course, you have to take certain precautions to do that. But the area is very interesting because the whole face of this particular canyon, there's several square pieces that have moved, obviously, from some sort of geological movement of the earth. And so they've shifted, and they look fairly precarious. But in there are some caves. But what's interesting is the front of this thing, there's one whole layer of blocks, if you will, that are missing, and they are not on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They are not on the ground.
So what does that tell you?
It tells me that they were transported somewhere else, and they were big. They're probably, these pieces range, I would say, like in a cube, they're 8 feet cubes.
Wow.
8 by 8 by 8, at least, if not 12 by 12 by 12. And, it took me a while to say, where'd the rest of the face of this go? Because you can see where the natural front was, and then it cuts back, and they're not laying there.
Now, where is this that you saw them? What state, what area?
I will be glad to tell you, but not in a public venue like this. But you have my phone number there. Feel free to call me back. I would love to chat more about it.
Possibly, George, can you tell us a bit, George, about the Megatron and the 50-foot-tall blue giants reputed as being certainly competent to move a 12-foot square block?
That's no problem there. Metatron himself, from the Hebrew lineage, Metatron was being 50 feet tall, and he had blue skin. But that had to do with... with the number of chromosomes that he had, I think, with his DNA. And, what I'd like to do is I'd like to jump back, if I could, for a minute with that question about the stone warriors.
Yes, the stone giants.
The stone giants, yeah. One tribe of people, like the Toltecs, what they would do is because before they would die... they would transfer their energy, their spiritual energy, into a physical object, into, let's say, a stone and so forth. And that the stone, the essence of that warrior, of that spirit, would be in that stone. And they would guide, guard a certain area. And I think Robert Goswolf, wrote in several of his books, he talked about an area up in the Four Corners area where you actually had stone warriors and they were guarding an area that was 3 miles high, and it was an area a couple miles in length at the top of a mountain plateau. And some believe, he thought that at one time this had to be some kind of library that held records or information. And in the same area, there was a sphinx that was carved out of a mountain. Now, I'm talking about the sphinx was, let's say, 100 feet by 50 feet wide. You know, it was pretty big. My point was some belief that they would revert their energy, their powers, into physical objects, and it would stay there for hundreds of years. And, you know, Carlos Castaneda's talked about some of his journeys with Don Juan and how there were some warriors that went and they buried themselves in a mountain. And, you know, naturally they died, but, you know, a couple of or 100 years later, they would come up and go into town and try to hook into an energy source. Sometimes it's the energy source would be a human being. And it's part of the old story about vampirism, you know, and vampires. Instead of blood, they're collecting vital human energy. But, you know, some of the old belief systems incorporated some of the alignments or the control of physical matter around us. You know, to look at this in a sense that you are creating the reality that you see, or you are holding together that reality that you're experiencing. But understand that when these spirits died, or when these Indians died, they're able to take that, freeze it, and implant it into an object and come back to it at a later time. And this is part of the abilities that we as sentinel beings have. Remember, we're sentinel beings having a human experience, not a human having a spiritual experience. So, you know, it's
that,
understanding
the powers.
That makes
total sense to what I understand is going on there, because of everything that I know about the area, it's definitely being guarded, and I definitely felt like that rock face, which was probably 8 or 12 feet tall,
yes,
looking over this canyon area, held that spirit. I knew the spirits were there and very strong that guarded that place.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had people there, and they've gotten confused. They've gotten, one guy got kind of thinking he was going to find something, got greedy, and he got spooked.
Yeah.
Another woman just got, like, totally almost electrocuted with the energy. I was fine. But then I own this piece of property, and there's some reason I do. You know, there's a reason I do.
Mm-hmm.
So at least that's my belief. So I am comfortable there. However, nearby, another piece I was on, I definitely had a vortex experience. So it's interesting you're talking about portals along with it, because I was driving.
When you said a vortex experience, what do you mean?
Okay, I'll explain. And
okay.
This just happened last week ago Tuesday. Let's see, what day is today? Friday?
Yes.
Yeah, week ago Tuesday. I was driving and I was looking for a brass marker. I was driving north on a northwest part of a section. And next thing I know, I'm finding a marker and making a note of, you know, the number on it and everything. And I continue driving the way my car's pointing, and I run into the river. Not in, literally, but, you know, to the edge.
Yeah.
And after, I had to leave the property before I even realized, wait a minute, I found something. I was going a whole different direction. All of a sudden, I found something that I was looking for. I had set my intention to find a brass marker, and I found one. But it wasn't the one I was supposed to be at. And how the heck did I get there? Because there's three tiers of land, you know, going down to the river that you just do not, you know, absentmindedly go down. You have to work your way down and avoid
mm-hmm.
ditches and ruts and, you know, take worn paths. And it took me getting away from the whole area to even realize I'd had that experience, because my mind was muddied.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
From so
Leo?
That was my experience.
Yeah, I'm there.
Leo, for the caller, speaking of these, we'll call transitional zones, another stone giant type story where bathers along the south shore of Long Island had the sense, for the caller, also of the presence of these large personages, and it turns out that along the same stretch of beach back in the 1870s, the very tall, almost giant Shinnecock Indians had helped unload a ship that was floundering in the near shore during a shipwreck, and it was during winter time. Unfortunately, a number of these very tall Shinnecock Indians ended up dying and being frozen into the sand dune that until the next spring were they thawed out as frozen sand entombed very tall people. And it seems today, even today, that that same presence of the beings, their death, a very significant historic event, and the giants, call them stone giants, again echo the same storyline.
Wow.
Well, that, no, it's amazing. It's amazing. And I'm sure there are many, many more connections to giants. I mean, Jared, you had mentioned it to us before in another show about place in the was it the Philippines?
That's right, yes. Mm-hmm. Guadalcanal Island.
Guadalcanal, right.
Island, yes.
Yeah.
And well, there's at least two different size giants. One was anywhere from 12 to 16 feet, and another one from 18 to 30 feet.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're still in existence, are they?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Uh-huh.
Witnessed, yeah. Yeah.
Well, just to finish up the story here, the remote viewer helped me know that I had caves and told me where to go to find them. Also said that when she was on the property, she did kind of an out-of-body type of remote viewing, that she felt like she was a giant. And so that's what got me started on the whole giant thing. And, you know, in other readings and dowsings, et cetera, my understanding is there are not giants there, but there are remains of their living, you know, not antiquities. I wouldn't call them antiquities, although they probably are. But, you know, not giant bones there, but other evidence of them being there. So, and I have no idea what that would look like personally, so at this point.
You know, it's amazing. This show has gone so fast. It's almost 9 o'clock. But I wanted to mention before we do, I want to thank all of you for joining me tonight. But I wanted to, is there anything... Brendan, that you feel you should that might be of significance for people to research or to check out more on this topic.
Well, again, Leo, I would ask people to start with Ross Hamilton's working website, and let me just spell again the beginning. It's OPHI for OFI, so it's OFI at Great Serpent Mound. .org. I think if you just type in Ross Hamilton and Serpent Mound, you'll find a plethora of information coming out on Google or other search engines.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Actually, I just wanted to mention I had done that, and the OFI at is more of an ad, OFI at would be more of a email. But when I went into that, I got nothing until I went in greatserpentmounds.org came up, and that was the one, just greatserpentmounds.org.
Okay.
So I would if you're out there looking, check out Great Serpent Mountain Mounds.
Yes, and Ross Hamilton's book again, A Tradition of Giants, is in spiral manuscript. His earlier book, The Mystery of the Serpent Mound, is also published. And Ross is currently working on StarCraft, where he's finding patterns in the mound structures of the Ohio Valley, where, again, Leo, many of these giants have been found in these mound structures, and Ross is seeing patterns such as the constellations possibly actually memorialized by the culture, possibly the Adena, who were the giant people of the Ohio Valley, and
right.
As you and I both realize the book, we've barely scratched chapter one or two. I'd be happy at any future time with you and George to come back to this issue. I feel we've just begun.
Well, we'd love to have you back, my friend.
Yeah, we could actually follow up on this not next week, but the following week when we're back on again on Friday night. Would you be interested?
Absolutely. I would be very much I think it's a great work here. I'm happy to hear from the caller. And just to mention that Vincent Gaddis's book, American Indian Myths and Mysteries in the 70s, speak of the entombment, like George was speaking of the gold and the artifacts in the Utah Valley area, as well as some of the tunnels, the Titan tunnels here in the East Coast that may be running up and down the Allegheny. So for getting entrance into and out of the underworld for the giants, if they're interterrestrials rather than extra, I think that there is, again, food for thought out there in the literature and much that we could chat about.
We're, we have 6 minutes, 3 seconds left, but I want to thank everybody for joining us. And, Brandon, we'll see you 2 weeks from now.
Be happy to be there.
And George, of course, George will be with us. And I believe it's Karen. Is that correct?
Yes.
Karen,
yes.
We'd love to have you join us as well, you know, and bring some more attention to these stone spirits and your research. I want to thank you very much.
Again, you have my number if you want to share that with the others that have been on.
Sure.
I'd love to talk more privately about that. And I'm actually leaving tomorrow to go visit this place. And I don't feel like I have permission yet to take a picture of this stone guardian. So if I do, I'll take one, but not until then.
Well, Karen, if you can keep me informed, I would appreciate it. And you can reach me at brotherdixon@AOL.com. That's Brother Dixon, D-I-C-K-S-O-N, at AOL.com. And, Brendan, if anybody would like to get a hold of you, they can also use my phone number.
Thank you so much. I'm below the radar, but always interested in hearing from my good friend George. And, Leo, it's been a pleasure to meet you.
All right. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. I'll give you a call before then.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Good
happy
night.
With you, my friend. Thank you.
Blessings. Right.
And Karen, as well, thank you, and have a pleasant week. And hopefully
thank you.
We'll see you,
thanks for taking my call.
A couple weeks, yeah.
Thanks for calling.
All right, thanks so much. And George, as always, salute you. It's been a lot of fun.
Okay, I'll keep in touch, Leo.
All right, have a great 4th of July, all right?
You also now.
Okay.
Goodbye now.
Good night.